Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Today on Truth and Movies, Terrence Malick returns with the sublime and spiritual Second World War drama, A Hidden Life.
What's happened to our country?
We're killing innocent people, raiding other countries, preying on the weak.
If our leaders, if they're evil, what does one do?
Then Charlize Theron, Nicole Kidman and Margot Robbie declare war on Fox News in Bombshell.
Fox News star Gretchen Carlson dropped a major bombshell today.
What is she doing?
This could kill Fox News.
We need everyone on Team Roger.
Get it on. Put it on.
These are the end times.
And in Film Club, it's back to Malick for his Oscar-winning 1978 masterpiece, Days of Heaven.
You know what I thought when I first saw you? I thought if only I could touch her, that everything'd be all right.
Three people whose destinies joined briefly in a dream. But how long could it last?
Well, coming up in Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Hello, movie truthers. It's Michael Leader here, sitting in the host chair, sitting across this week from David Jenkins.
Hey there.
And Rogan Graham.
Hiya.
How are we doing this week? David, we have some big news from the White Lies Towers, don't we? Since the last episode, we've announced the new issue.
Yes, and I think this it seems like an appropriate time to mention it, really, seeing as what we're covering this week. But A Hidden Life by Terrence Malick is, in fact, our latest cover film, issue 83. The magazine, this issue, comes with a special double connecting cover with the two characters in the film. You count yourself among the kind of crazy LWL elite crew, then you can buy both and connect them together, and they create a nice big kind of diptych.
Yes,
diptych artwork. The cover artist was this guy called Niall Grant, and yeah, in the issue we're kind of like I'm basically a Malick super fan. The Tree of Life was the film, as I may have mentioned on a past pod, because I think we did Tree of Life as a film club, but The Tree of Life was a film that really kind of was a moment for me, a bit of a kind of epiphany. I wouldn't have described myself as the kind of biggest Malick fan on the basis of like the films he made between Badlands and New World, and although I like them, I think I've wanted to do a Malick cover for like, you know, ever since that film, or you know, for this entire decade, but you know, for whatever reason, he has taken a bit more of an experimental bent in his output. Films like Song to Song and Voyage of Time didn't even get a release here, for instance. Like connecting them up to releases has just been impossible. So sometimes I haven't even been able to like include reviews in the magazine because they've come out so last minute and in you know, barely any venues. So this issue is about Hidden Life, but it's also a kind of ode to Terrence Malick and his work, and it's, you know, it's not like it's basic, you know, for readers maybe worried about it's like, you know, going on and on about how great he is. It's more of a kind of objective critical look at his films rather than a kind of full bore loving, because obviously these new films aren't to all tastes, but I think maybe this new one is something that could maybe bring back some of the people who have lost faith.
Ah, and this podcast is our own sort of ode to Terrence Malick. Of course, we're talking about A Hidden Life, but then in Film Club at the end of the show, we'll be talking about Days of Heaven.
Indeed,
one of those films in that area where you weren't such a super fan, perhaps.
Indeed, there's the, in the issue we've actually got these really. I'm just like stunned by them, but we got like these 10 little essays each on, it's a kind of like dossier on all the films, or a symposium, whatever you want to call it, but each individual film has its own mini essay, and we kind of focus on a specific aspect on it, about each film. And I think when you kind of read them all together, you just get this really, I think, beautiful portrait of what he's doing now and what he's done. And I just think he is like the cat's pajamas. So that old saying.
But before we do dive into Terrence Malick and this week's new releases, we have an email about one of the films we talked about in the last episode. Rogan, have you had a chance to see 1917 yet?
I haven't seen it yet, no.
Well, I don't know if this email will convince you to go and see it, but this is from Anthony in Alicante. He says, I went to see 1917 last night and was very much looking forward to it, as I find the two world wars fascinating periods in history, and films about them are generally worthy of comment and discussion, even at their least meritorious. But my overriding impression, having watched the film, is that it's beautifully shot and looks fantastic, something we've come to expect from Roger Deakins. But I did feel that it's hamstrung by some very wooden dialogue and actually pretty sixth form am-dram delivery on the part of the actor who played Blake. Some of the parts I found a bit mawkish and cliched, especially the scene with the French woman and the baby. However, it's definitely a film with its heart in the right place, and I'd even be willing to give it a second chance to see if I was being unfair in my assessment the first time around. Anthony, thank you for your email. We actually have another film about the Second World War, well, about the World Wars, coming up this week. That's A Hidden Life, which we'll talk about now. But listeners, if you do watch any of the films that we talk about and want to send in some feedback that we can read out, you can do so at the usual channels, at Truth and Movies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email, or at the comments page at lwlies.com/podcast. Now, let's kick off with this week's big movie, A Hidden Life. The latest from visionary writer-director Terrence Malick, A Hidden Life is the story of an unsung hero who refused to fight for the Nazis in the Second World War. When an Austrian peasant farmer is faced with the threat of execution for treason, it is unwavering faith and his love for his wife and children that keeps his spirit alive.
What's happened to our country?
We're killing innocent people,
raiding other countries, preying on the weak.
If our leaders, if they're evil, what does one do?
You have a duty to the fatherland. The church tells you so.
You cannot say no to your race and your hope. You are a traitor.
A short clip from A Hidden Life there. So, David Jenkins, Terrence Malick superfan, could you put this film in context? What we can expect from A Hidden Life?
Well, I would say when you described Terrence Malick in your little kind of preamble blurb there, you described him as visionary director, and that's obviously like a thing that crops up on a lot of film posters these days.
Like Zack Snyder and J.J. Abrams, right?
Exactly, exactly. And I would say that he is probably one of a very, very, very small, tiny coterie of filmmakers who actually is deserving of the name, because I think what he's doing is actually, you know, it is visionary in that it is looking beyond the conventional, and he is trying to kind of tell stories in a completely new and different way. The evolution of that voice, we've kind of been able to sort of chart it over the last decade, and with the previous film he made, Song to Song, was maybe the kind of probably the most experimental, in that it was the most fractured and the least linear and the least narrative driven. And I think what A Hidden Life does is maybe pulls back a little bit, and I think harks back to films like Thin Red Line and New World a little bit more, in that it tells a linear story of Franz and Fanny Jägersätter, the farmers living this extremely idyllic rural mountain life in the sort of little village of Sunt Radegund. For the first kind of hour of the film, In the background, you kind of see the sort of rumblings of war and the rise of Hitler and conscriptions increasing and people in the village being called upon and celebrating the fact that they are going to be fighting for the fatherland. And it's this kind of creeping stranglehold of the Nazis as they essentially force Franz to join the army or fight for the Nazis in some aspect, even if it's just as a hospital porter, where he's kind of, you know, keeping his powder dry to some extent. And yet Franz, played by August Diehl, you know, he can't accept giving himself over to in the name of what he sees as evil. And his wife Fanny, played by Valerie Packner, amazing performance from both of them, is they have this kind of very elemental love, and the film is a kind of conversation like about morals and ethics and what it means to have a connection to your country. And I think it's really kind of in some aspect trying to sort of like ask not just the big questions but the biggest questions about, you know, is there a God, and if there was, what would he look like? How would we see him? How would he talk to us? And there are sort of passages in the rest in the end of this film where you genuinely believe that there is like some kind of like divine presence who is there, or like maybe not as a sort of physical being, but like you kind of understand that it's kind of the idea of light and darkness and physical, you know, the physicality of the world and nature. And it's kind of, this is going to sound really like weird, but like trying to sort of define God as this kind of abstract concept. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I think he's been doing a lot in his films, and it kind of connects it to this later run of work. I was really kind of like blown away by it on the first viewing, and then the second viewing it kind of totally got me again, and I don't know, hopefully we'll watch it again soon.
Spoken like a true believer. Mm. There, David. Rogan, are you faithful to the Malick cause?
Please offend me.
No, not at all. I was saying to Michael before actually we started, so I saw Days of Heaven like when I was a lot younger, because when I was getting into film, I went by actor. So I watched Pretty Woman, and I thought, I know. And I thought, okay, amazing. I'll just go back Richard Gere, sure. So I saw Days of Heaven, and I remember loving it at the time, but not quite knowing why or understanding, just sort of knowing how to articulate it. And then rewatched it for Film Club. And then I'd seen Tree of Life, and then I've seen A Hidden Life. And so they're the only three Malick films I've actually seen. And I think they... just from Days of Life, then for me jumping to Tree of Life, I can just see the overlap with the kind of orb-like, godlike camera just kind of peering in on these lives. And yeah, I thought Hidden Life was really beautiful and really moving, and I loved, of course it's about Nazis, but you can kind of apply it to any, it isn't too heavy-handed, there's no extreme kind of violence or brutality. It's, he trusts that you know what they're up against and you understand, because we already know. You don't need to kind of bang this sort of war drum that a lot of movies tend to do, I think. But yeah, no, I loved it. I thought it was really beautiful, and the performances were so moving. Their love, I think of it personally just as a love story. She would kind of love a dead man than love a fascist, and he would rather be a dead man than lose her love, kind of thing. That's what it feels like, without kind of saying it as explicitly as that. And yeah, no, but now I'm a bit worried, because I know that his film, sort of between A Tree of Life and Hidden Life, are a lot more contentious, I think. And I don't want to ruin it for myself.
I'm quite open that I'm relatively allergic to late Malick, particularly many of the... Maybe we could unpack some of the stylistic, you know, distinctive qualities that he has in these later films, which you can see in his earlier films as well, but come really to the fore in the last four films. where it's, he uses pretty much one lens for the entire film, that this wide lens that allows the camera to just be moving through space and follow these actors as they twirl around or fall in heather or jump into hay, as they do in a very beautiful scene in this film, The Hidden Life. But then he also shoots a lot and often finds the film in the edit room, and then maybe sometimes picks up or does extra shoots later down the line, which means that often his films take shape over a long period of time. And we hear these wonderful stories of actors who say they're in the new Terrence Malick film, and then when the film finally comes out, there's no actual trace of them. The famous case being Adrian Brody in The Thin Red Line, who thought he was the protagonist. And Is he in the final cut?
I think he's in a small, very, very small role.
Mm-hmm. And the same,
Jared Leto as well.
Oh, right. And the same goes with Song to Song, which we knew that Terrence Malick was filming at various music festivals, and the various musicians who are going to pop up and have major roles in that film. And then you may get a glimpse of Patti Smith in the background of a scene. Or she delivers a monologue in that film, doesn't she?
She has one of the best moments, actually. There's a scene in it where she has a conversation with Rooney Mara as a kind of maternal figure, and it's really beautiful. Yeah.
Which, for me, I can understand the attraction of how that can be a very organic, a very unique, a very authored approach to these films. But I often find myself almost wanting him to go back to what Badlands and Days of Heaven were, which were a little bit more wrestled into an hour and a half long structure rather than billowing out into in form. But The Hidden Life, as you said, David, does come across as his most linear and most written film for a decade, and that really does work. Could you talk to the skeptics and say why this one is worth jumping on board of if they've watched, say, To the Wonder, and they're done with voiceover and twirling and all of the slightly parodic elements of Malick?
Well, you know, I think, you know, some people have like made their mind up on him, and you know, on one hand, I think he has made a film that can much more easily connect to a broader audience because of those things that you say talk about before. In that, I guess let's call them the sort of experimental phase. There was a very unconventional take on things like character and narrative and linearity and all that kind of stuff. So he didn't really give you much to, you know, they were kind of pure psychological studies, and they didn't give you much to sort of anchor yourself, or you had no idea where the film was going to go next. They were episodic and like very sort of like inspired by montage rather than narrative. And this one, I think, you know, it brings back some of those kind of core base elements, like, you know, you have characters that, and you see them develop over a period of time, and you have a story, and in a way you even have like heroes and antagonists as well. So even though, as Rogan says, you don't really see the Nazis, I mean, you see there's a few bits of newsreel which kind of are there purely for context. But more than that, there isn't much. But it is this kind of slow burn story where of a character over a period of time. And I think that those other films are sort of taking almost picking out random chunks of time from a person's life, whereas this is the story of from when Franz Jägersätter went from, you know, having a wonderful life to basically, I'm trying to try not to spoil it here, but like taking his having to become a conscientious objector in Nazi Germany, so, and being torn apart from his wife and how she reacted to it as well. So there is like a conventional story there, but that's not to say that he it's not stealthily bringing in these other aspects of like spirituality. And I think one of the other things as well that often I'm going to call them the haters that they feel that they've been preached at by him, that he is like a god boy, and he is his films are about how we should embrace God and Christianity or some kind of like faith, and that should be kind of an aspect that drives us in life, and that his films are like didactic, and I just absolutely have never thought that and never seen that. And I think that they're more about a curiosity and trying to define or present what that means, what it means to be faithful, or to have some kind of guiding light in that is only seen by you in your life. And I mean, if anything, I think these films are showing different types of like things that people see that or perhaps in their own mind that the camera can't see, and he's trying to like, it's like, I'm going to try and see it. If that isn't like the height of ambition as a filmmaker, then I don't know what is, really.
And I think this film is the perfect context for that. And I responded to that so much better in this film, maybe because of the context of release of this film. If you thought that 1917 was shorn of context of what war, the real big questions behind war, and you thought Jojo Rabbit might have been flippant and sentimental, this film really asks the big questions about being a person in a country where war is breaking out, or you're being, due to an alliance between two countries, brought into war. And I'd put this alongside First Reformed and Silence, of these great old blokes of New Hollywood who are wrestling with their faith and spiritualism with a lifetime's worth of film craft behind them.
Absolutely.
And yes, so they didn't fully convert me, this film, but I took much more from it than I have in the past. Let's wrap this up, though. Of course, there's a whole magazine about the film and Malick that we can go and read. But Rogan, I'll come to you first. What scores would you give this, and any final comments on A Hidden Life? But the scores would be in anticipation, enjoyment, in retrospect.
I think I'd give it 3 in anticipation, just because I didn't know much about it, but I was like, yeah, I liked Terrence Malick before.
Would it have been a film that you'd have maybe gone to see obviously off your own steam? Because I mean, it's 3 hours, so it's a considerable.
Probably, because I was thinking as I was watching it, and then you mentioned Silence. I went to see Silence like 2 or 3 times in the cinema, and then as I was watching it, I saw it at home, and I was like, I'm gonna have to seek it out. So I did. I'd say enjoyment. I don't want to say 5 because that's like really high. That's you know, but I did really enjoy it, so I give it a 4, and then I think a 4 in retrospect as well. Yeah, it was so moving. And I can't think of a reason to tell someone not to watch it. You know, just go, just sit and watch it, and you'll get something. Yeah, for sure.
It also has the final performance from the great Bruno Ganz in it, doesn't it?
So yeah, yeah.
That's more than enough reason to go and see this
and
film.
And Michael Nyquist.
Oh, of course, yes. Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Two of the actors died prior to release.
Yeah. What scores did you review this for the mag for them?
No,
for the
no. So I would thoroughly recommend people pick up the magazine to read my august and esteemed colleague Sophie Monks Kaufman, who's written at length on the film, and it's better than I could ever do. So I absolutely think you should pick if only for that review, pick up the magazine. It's predictable, but it's like, you know, it's one of the best films of the year. Well, I was a little. I mean, a lot of people are talking about Oscar snubs and whatnot, and you know, I think when this premiered at Cannes, it was picked up by Fox. I think there was a feeling that, oh, this could, you know, if not go the distance, then at least be in the mix. And it's just, you know, it's just been, you know, scattered by the wayside. And the cynical dark heart of me thinks that all the chips have been placed on Jojo Rabbit at the expense of this, and I think that makes me hate Jojo Rabbit even more.
So what scores would you give if you reviewed it?
5s.
Okay.
Of course. I mean, I think I've given every film since The Tree of Life. and you know, we'll continue doing so. I mean, so just a final bit of goss that he is currently in the process of making a film about the life of Jesus, starring Mark Rylance. So, you know.
As Jesus.
Bring it on.
Or
I'm not sure who is playing Jesus.
Who would you cast Mark Rylance in the Jesus story? That's a good
he would
question.
I think he would be a good Jesus, though.
Yeah.
Definitely. From Bing to Jesus.
I think scores-wise for me, this is going to be one of those rare rising scores where I think, you know, I will watch a Malick film because it feels like, you know, required viewing at this point, but I'm not, you know, jumping at the opportunity, so probably 2, 3, 4. This is one that I'm looking forward to watching again. Hopefully, if I can get the chance to see it in the cinema, that would be fantastic. And yes, if that does, it sounds like if this is the perfect marriage of spiritualism and film, actually doing a Jesus movie would be even better, right? So who knows how that will pan
out.
Well,
let's see. I mean, you know, I think his films have been about like that aspect of spirituality, but in like different contexts. Mm-hmm. So actually bringing it back home. I mean, this could be, you know, this he's getting on a bit now. This, you know, this could be his last movie, and you know, would seem to be an apt sign off.
And that was A Hidden Life in cinemas this week. Let us know what you think if you do have a chance to see it. Up next, we have an Oscar hopeful, Bombshell. The latest from the visionary director of Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me, Bombshell is a revealing look inside the most powerful and controversial media empire of all time, Fox News, and the explosive story of the women who brought down the infamous man who founded it.
Someone has to speak up. Someone has to get mad.
Fox News star Gretchen Carlson dropped a major bombshell today.
What is she doing?
This could kill Fox News.
We need everyone on Team Roger.
Get it on. Put it on.
These are the end times.
You do understand I have to be above this, right?
You know the entire country is talking about your period right now. So you're
a tough guy like you really want. A short clip from the trailer for Bombshell there. So Charlize Theron and Margot Robbie both got their Oscar nominations mm-hmm. for lead actress and supporting actress, respectively. Is that well deserved, Rogan?
I found Charlize Theron in this film terrifying.
Yes.
She had, like, kind of dead shark eyes for a lot of it. I understand why she got the nomination, because she has prosthetics on and it's a real person. Yeah, it makes sense that they were nominated, but I'm not sure.
To go back to that point about being terrified, it's true, really.
Yeah.
It's one of those films where maybe you've seen the poster, maybe you've seen the trailer. I hadn't seen the trailer, I had seen the poster, but because in the poster, it's almost like a news anchor lineup where you have Nicole Kidman, Margot Robbie and Charlize Theron, and you only see maybe half their faces because they're doing that lineup type shot. I didn't know Charlize Theron was Megyn Kelly in this film, and it took me maybe two scenes to really clock that it was her, because she's putting on that monotonous voice that's almost maybe half an octave lower than she naturally speaks. Mm. And she is, I can't really figure out what prosthetics she's got on her face. This is, we should say, the next film from the guy who brought you Winston Churchill in The Darkest Hour, and you know, Kazuhiro, who is he used to be a great makeup artist and in genre cinema, and now it seems that he's the guy that makes Oscar bait come to life, as we see also with John Lithgow, who needs to be seen to be believed as Roger Ailes. But Rogan, you said that you didn't really know this story beforehand. Did this film do a good job of telling that story for someone who maybe doesn't know Fox News, doesn't know Megyn Kelly, etc.?
In terms of now I know what happened,
mm-hmm.
lots of women who worked there put up with abuse from mm-hmm. him, sort of out of fear for ruining their careers. And then Nicole Kidman's character decided that she wouldn't tolerate it anymore. And then Murdoch turfed, what's his name?
Roger Ailes
out. Like, you kind of, you learn that much. But I'm not sure if you needed it needed to be a film.
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
And I did think that as this was going on, you can see almost the pitch meeting behind it. We've got the Darkest Hour makeup guy. That's your best makeup and hair Oscar in the bag. We've got, you know, I mean, Jay Roach, we're joking saying he's the Austin Powers guy, but he has made a lot of TV.
He's the Trumbo guy.
He made Trumbo, but then he also mm-hmm. has done a lot of sort of TV, true life, political dramas. But he clearly wants to level up and become Adam McKay. He wants to do a Vice mm-hmm. or a Big Short on this. And mm-hmm. there is the first half hour of the film has a lot of fourth wall breaking narration, mm-hmm. people stopping the action and explaining things about Fox News, and also Margot Robbie, who turns up in Adam McKay films. But it doesn't sustain that energy throughout, does it?
No, it picks up a little bit when there's a kind of bizarre, almost in memoriam like segment that's like a sort of black slideshow of women who've accused Roger Ailes, and that was just really strange, actually, mm-hmm. the way that was done. And I don't know, I just didn't understand any of the kind of choices that were made. It was like, there's no such thing as like a perfect victim of when it comes to anything, especially sexual harassment. By kind of, it glossed over a lot of just how dangerous Fox News is, and the words a lot of these women sort of spewed on air. I'd like, you just really glossed over it so that you maybe would feel more sympathy for them. And then in the end, you don't know why the film's made because you don't know who it's for.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be for people who are the butt of Fox News jokes or constantly picked on by them. And it's not going to be for the women who didn't support Gretchen Carlson and Megyn Kelly initially when this story broke. So then what was the point of it? It just doesn't really make sense. It just seems like a hot topic that they just were like, oh, well, we should probably do this, you know, it'll make some money, it's of the time. And it's not done very well.
The rush to make a Me Too movie.
Yeah.
And maybe there's some intrigue in, we can make a Me Too movie about the conservatism, which is Fox News. But in the process, it does come very close to valorising the great journalists of Fox News. There's even a character that must be another fictional character that's played by Kate McKinnon, who is actually the journalists at Fox News are lefties and snowflakes and have Hillary Clinton posters on the walls at home.
Yeah.
Maybe they're not as bad as we think they are.
Yeah, exactly. It's like picking fun at them while also, you know, not picking too much. We still respect them to some degree. It just can't make up its mind. Like, you know, when Margot Robbie's character delivers the line, she says something like, I'm an evangelical millennial. There's no place for me anywhere. Or so, like something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And then she goes home with Kate McKinnon's character and discovers that she's closeted. Kate McKinnon's character's closeted at work. And she has this Hillary Clinton poster. Thinking, what were you... like, what are you getting at here? That, like, these people who kind of support this, like, institution are all sort of in denial, and so it doesn't really matter what they do. And, like, the whole idea of complicity. Like, you could have made quite an interesting film maybe about how willing people are to forgive things until they directly affect them. But he just doesn't.
It's a very scattershot film. As well, there's this sort of Pyrrhic victory at the end where Roger Ailes is ousted, but it's made very clear that this is just new boss same as the old boss, because Fox is now pivoting to hard Trump support, and Trump, you know, we all know now how that story ends. But it sort of flubs that as well. You think that's something that maybe in all of his sort of flippant comedy politics, you know, Adam McKay probably could have pulled off, that actually we've killed Grand Moff Tarkin, but the Emperor's coming in for Empire Strikes Back up next.
Yeah, even I'm thinking towards the end of the film when it's the kind of the Murdoch sons, the brothers, who sort of have, it's like they have it in for Roger Ailes, and so they get rid of him in the end. And we know what the Murdochs represent, but they're the good guys who kicked out the sex offender. And you're like, why is that the kind of the narrative we're going with? It was just so confused.
It's quite hard to find much to enjoy in this film, really. One thing I did enjoy is seeing some very big performances from supporting actors here. I think Alison Janney turns up as Roger Ailes' attorney in a couple of scenes, and she's adopting an incredible accent, whatever she's going for. And then all the way through, you know that Murdoch's going to show up at some point, and it's Malcolm McDowell, which I think is almost... he doesn't even need prosthetics, really. He just shows up with a very bad Australian accent, and that's it.
He looks like one of those dogs that have got too much skin on their face.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they are. I'm not a dog man, so... Yeah.
But are you a Bombshell man?
No. it was a sort of like a film that was kind of, you know, started, and I was thinking, this is quite nice, and then it just sort of ended. Oh, okay. It's, as you say, has all these kind of over the top performances, and it's just a very strange film about, as Rogan says, like trying to, I guess, sort of split this idea of, like, you know, even conservatives can have a bad time, you know. And there's that weird scene in the supermarket where Gretchen Carlson, played by Nicole Kidman, is confronted by a woman who has a go at her for her lawsuit against Roger Ailes, and she, you know, they have this argument about, I can't remember what it is she says, actually.
She says Gretchen Carlson says something like, how you treat people who disagree with you says everything about you, or it says everything about your character, or something like that. Yeah, something like
that. But the subtext being benign acceptance is better than actually like standing your ground, especially in these matters. That it just it just felt very icky. It felt like they had an idea for a film, but not an actual film. Like, I'm really like down on all. Like, I thought the performances were all very hammy, and they were very kind of mannered, and I just, you know, seeing a film about that's in a way kind of valorizes aspects of Fox News, which has now become like almost a kind of North Korean state sponsored news channel now, in which, you know, Trump pipes in and his own propaganda through their anchors. It's just like, you know, is that not the story here? You know, it's like, you know, what did these events give way to? I mean, it feels very similar to Trumbo in a way. I mean, there was, you know, it's that film as well. It was like a potentially interesting, bigger thematic story about oppression and suppression, and, you know, a clash of ideologies, and, you know, that film being about the McCarthyism and witch hunts and whatnot. But I just think Jay Roach in making these films doesn't really, I think he is more interested in these almost like Wikipedia-esque, like, and then sort of bringing in the characters, making sure you've got like Richard Kind as Rudy Giuliani for like a second. It's like, and then making sure he's hitting all these touch points and getting all these people in at the expense of like a drama or something, of saying, of a statement, of making some kind of provocative statement about anything. It's just, it's very kind of, oh, here's a bunch of stuff that happened and take from it what you will.
It strikes me as a film that didn't have a draft script. It had a draft for your consideration page, really. And it's, and congratulations,
it's worked.
It got all those it got those nominations that it was aiming for. What scores would you give this, Rogan?
Anticipation, probably a 2, just because I do like the cast, but I don't know, they're not like, it's not like top of my list to see a film about them, especially the subject matter. And then watching it, probably again a 2. Yeah, again, I liked Margot Robbie's performance, and I think her phone call towards the end with Kate McKinnon, I found that like really affecting. But I mean, it's the part of the film that didn't happen. Like, so it just points to again how it was just completely just confused, just very confused. And then again, a 2 in retrospect, just because you don't really learn much from it that you can't read on Wikipedia, and it's not very interesting, or it doesn't really say anything. Which I think is the worst thing, because I don't hate it either. I just don't.
I agree, 2s across the board for me. David, what do you think?
Same. I maybe even a 1 at the end there, just because the in retrospect score is like, oh man, this film, I think it has not done very well at the box office, but obviously it's now got this awards boost, which will maybe bump it up a bit. I'm just sort of depressed. And I think Vice, the Adam McKay film from last year, didn't do particularly well, even though Christian Bale ended up getting an Oscar nomination, I think. But these films are kind of like, I think I've just got this terrible vision of them being the kind of Oscar filler for like the next decade. We're going to have some kind of real life film about some awful right wing conservative aimed at a liberal audience to kind of like, you know, smirk at and then probably like dismiss quite swiftly, at the expense of like actually amazing films that like Hidden Life, Uncut Gems, that have just been, you know, poo-pooed, and they don't fit into this kind of, here is an actor, they are doing a performance kind of template that the Academy seem to cleave to. I'm not that bitter about the Academy. I don't really care that much, to be honest. But, you know, it seems like the time to be talking about these things, really.
So, thought experiment for listeners. 5 years' time, 10 years' time, we're going to have the Weinstein movie.
Yes.
Kazuhiro can be in on makeup and prosthetics. Who's going to go for that best actor play?
Oh,
I'm not going to put you two on the spot, don't worry, listeners.
Let's think of, we can think about it while we're talking about Days of Heaven.
Yes, but listeners, let us know if you have any suggestions. Maybe we can pass it on to these actors, agents. Let us know at Truth and Movies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email, or at the comments section at lewelies.com/podcast. Up next, Film Club, back to Malik for Days of Heaven.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
So it's back to 1978 now for Terrence Malick's Days of Heaven, the only film of his to win an Oscar to date, in which Richard Gere stars as a hot-tempered farm labourer who convinces the woman he loves to marry their rich but dying boss so they can have a claim to his fortune. Before we chat about it, let's hear a clip.
Days of Heaven, the story of a man who had nothing. The woman who loved him.
You're crazy.
And the man who would give her everything for a share of that love.
You know what I thought when I first saw you? I thought if only I could touch her, that everything would be all right.
Three people whose destinies joined briefly in a dream. But how long could it last?
A little bit of Days of Heaven's trailer there. So, Rogan, I want to hear, what did your teenage self think of this film after watching Pretty Woman?
I was surprised. I don't know. I didn't know what I'd gotten myself in for. But I remember...
Did you also do a Julia Roberts run as well?
Mystic Pizza is one of my favourite films. Yeah. I did, yeah. But yeah, no, Days of Heaven. So I just remember, I mean, I'm a London girl sort of through and through, and I think I remember thinking to myself, like, I've never been so interested in cornfields before. I just love looking at his films. Just watch it. Even I feel like I just can get absorbed without actually worrying about the performances performances were great and I found the story interesting, but I was just so enraptured in how the film looks. That's what I remember of it. And then on rewatch, I became more invested. Yeah, the first time I didn't really watch for Richard Gere. I found it through Richard Gere, and then I sort of forgot about him because I came swept up in the.
Did you have a bit of a Sam Shepard run there?
A Sam Shepard run? I didn't actually. No, I feel like I should have done. I'm missing out on something. Yeah,
that is a tough choice to make between Sam Shepard and Richard Gere, both at the height of their gorgeous powers in this film.
Yeah, angular, kind of sexy phase.
Yeah, exactly. Who would you have gone for, David?
If I was Brooke Adams,
yes.
I've got to put myself into the mind. Tough call. This is probably the Malick film I've seen the most because it's the shortest. But I think the reason I've seen it the most is because there's a little kind of bugbear I have with it, and it's a bugbear that I don't have with his later stuff because they're not so narrative driven. But this film is based on a very specific plot point where you have Richard Gere is an iron worker who, and in the beginning there is this kind of, you know, you see he has this altercation with his boss and whacks him over the head with a lead pipe and scarpers. We don't know if he's killed him or, you know, looks like he has, but he scarpers with Brooke Adams and Linda Manns.
Their siblings, Linda Manns and Richard Gere.
Yeah,
and his sister. But then Brooke Adams is posing as Richard Gere's sister.
Exactly. So
even though they're lovers.
And there is this line about, we told them we were brother and sister because it's easier, and that she was our daughter. she was a sister as well. And it's that kind of status, is that you know, them presenting themselves as brother and sister is what allows Sam Shepard's character to basically think he can court Brooke Adam. And I've never really been able to sort of work out why they decide to do that, because the whole film is based on this kind of little white lie they tell, mm-hmm. that is for me doesn't seem that necessary. I mean, I talked to loads of people about this, and like, you know, people say that it's like, oh, it would have been easier for them, or, you know, it was just, you know, it would have looked bad for them to have been lovers out of wedlock and have what looks like a daughter. So yeah, it's just been this very weird little niggling thing which has maybe dulled my appreciation of the film ever so slightly, because it happens at the beginning, it does hang over the film, and it's something that I'm kind of conscious of and thinking about as I'm sort of drinking in all these extraordinary scenes, you know, mm-hmm. like absolutely like jaw-dropping, staggering. I mean, I think that if you were to pick out your top five of all the best cinematography winners, this would probably be in that top five, and it might even win it, to be mm-hmm. honest, because mm-hmm. I mean, it is really like jaw drops to the floor and then sort of through the floor kind of levels. Yeah, the cinematography, Nestor Almendros, who did lots of like interestingly, did loads of like Eric Rohmer films, a great French director, but in a completely different style. I mean, those films were very kind of subtle, small, quite a lot of handheld camera, not a lot of framing. This is like, you know, beautiful, pictorial, almost kind of painterly style that he's using here, and the light and the shadow and you can basically see the weather in this film, mm-hmm. which is like, you know, again, something that Malick does a lot, which in his kind of quest to sort of visualize the spiritual world, I think.
It's interesting that you talk about storytelling, David, because Malick has had a weird reputation before this as a great screenwriter. He came up as a script doctor. He did some behind the scenes rewrites on Dirty Harry, of all films, and Badlands is held up as like one of the great kind of runaway crime films of the early 70s of the New Hollywood period. And this is the first film, I guess, that he did what he would do later, which is find the film in the shoot and the edit. He did have a script, but he was shooting the script and hated it and threw it out. And I think that's something that Richard Gere is maybe struggling with. And you can see that some actors maybe are a bit more up for that than others. Linda Manns being the absolute revelation in this film, right? She didn't really do much else after this. She pops up in, is it Gummo? And that's...
Yeah, she you know. So just a quick thing on Linda Manns. There's a whole essay in our new issue on Linda Manns, which you should definitely read. But he eventually came around to having her do the narration of the film by showing her the film and getting her to describe what she was seeing. So it was a kind of improvised narration, and she was doing it so amazingly well, and in this kind of naturally poetic and slightly off-kilter way that it just worked perfectly for the film. Manns heads would definitely be up for, be worth seeking out the film Out of the Blue, Dennis Hopper.
Of course,
film,
yes, I have seen that film, yeah.
Where she plays like a kind of young teen rebel punk kid, and she is just like off the charts mm-hmm. extraordinary. And it's like one of the great sort of lost classics, I think. So yeah, Out of the Blue. And then she's had a few bits, like she was in The Game, the David Fincher film, for a brief moment, and then she was in Gummo as well, and I'm not sure she's been in much since, but you know, she was like, I went off and had a family and had a normal life.
But I think that gets to the heart of why I maybe prefer these early Malick films to the later ones, where he, I don't want to speculate on whether it is ego or auteur theory or what. There are collaborators on these films that come to the fore more so than Malick and his great vision. We've already talked about the cinematography. We can talk as much about Ennio Morricone's score or Leo Kottke's amazing guitar work that pops up on the score as well, or Linda Manns as author of this work in a way, because she's the voice that unites it all. That becomes less and less, because particularly during that experimental period that leads from Tree of Life to now, where actors are just people to be cut up and moved around and shaped by the great Malick. Would you contend against that, or would you argue with that?
So well, I think, you know, so what you're saying is basically Malick is kind of casting himself as God in the later films as a kind of omnipotent presence. And I think it would be hard to speculate, really. I think that you know, the impression that I get from his later films is that most of the films are entirely improvised, and a lot of the he's using like fragments of dialogue, and he doesn't say action and cut, and you know, he films his rehearsals. So I mean, everything is like, I think it'd be hard to sort of give a hard and fast, like, these are the collaboration films and these are the kind of Malick hardcore auteur films.
I mean, not even speculating about how it works behind the scenes. As a viewer, I come away thinking more about Linda Manns than I necessarily would about the actors in Hidden Life, even though they give great performances. It is that overarching vision, maybe. I don't know, Rogan, do you have a point of view on that? Do you see something different about Days of Heaven compared to Hidden Life?
Yeah, no, I do agree with what you mean, actually. I think I do. I can watch Days of Heaven. I mean, like, obviously, I initially didn't watch it as a Terrence Malick film. I watched it as a Richard Gere film. But I can look at it, I feel like I can watch it more independently and I don't necessarily have to consider his work, whereas I feel like I can't watch Tree of Life. I have to think about, okay, so what is he trying to do as a whole? So I kind of know what you mean in terms of more collaborative work versus more sort of, yeah.
Having seen these three films, almost the extremes of his career, would you be willing to dig deeper?
Yeah, I definitely would. I am like a bit... song to song, I just have a friend who like hates it so viciously that I'm like, oh no. But no, I think I will. I think I'm gonna make it, like, I've got like my little list for the year of like, I'm gonna go deeper with, and I think Malick.
Which would you recommend?
I would say the To the Wonder irked a lot of people because that's got the most twirling in it. But the film that I think brought some people back and people liked a bit more was Knight of Cups.
The
Christian Bale one where he's like weirdly a Hollywood comedy writer. The joke is there's no jokes or no humour, and you never see him writing or you never see him being funny in the entire film. But yeah, that's one that is kind of one of the sort of easier ones to digest, I think. Yeah.
I think Malick's like Kubrick. There's somebody who says every single one of their films is their best.
Yeah.
So you'll find somebody who really goes hard for the New World out there. There's a small community of them. Then the Badlands stands all the way through.
And Tree of Life's probably now the kind of 2001, the one that most people probably think is the one.
Well, that was his blockbuster, wasn't it?
I guess, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, after people being absolutely petrified of not having any idea what to do with it for a long, long time. That's one of the key films where, like, it winning a major festival prize was, like, a great thing for it. At least seemed to have an obvious impact on what people thought about it and the kind of, oh, I need to see this film now to have an opinion on it.
So many directions, listeners, you can go there from Days of Heaven and Hidden Life. If you do go down the Terrence Malick rabbit hole, let us know what you think at the usual channels. Next week... we have a new release from Armando Iannucci. It's The Personal History of David Copperfield. We have Queen and Slim. And then for Film Club, we have The Holy Mountain from 1973. Any words on The Holy Mountain, gang?
You know what? I've never seen The Holy Mountain.
Wow.
I've only seen El Topo.
I haven't seen The Holy Mountain either. I've seen El Topo. This is Alejandro Jodorowsky.
Yeah, I think I've seen Santa Sangre, and I've seen his like two newer films, but never partaken in The Holy Mountain.
I hear it's quite a trip. Let us know what you think about Alejandro Jodorowsky, listeners at the usual channels. Until then, David, Rogan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Michael Eder, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.